Good morning. We're here with Kevin Fisher, who is the executive director of NAMI Michigan, and we're attending the 2024 summer conference in Traverse City. Good morning, Kevin.
Good morning. How are you?
Good.
Thank you for having me.
My pleasure. I was so excited that you had made the time to do this today.
No, I'm excited.
Kevin is going to tell us about his journey and how he became very active, well-respected, and I'd venture to say respectfully, like very much liked in our community. People that meet you, you're a very kind man, always open and listening to others, and that's what makes you special.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Thank you for all your work.
Thank you. So, my journey to becoming a behavioral health care advocate began in 2008, I'll say. In 2007, November 2007, my oldest son, Dominique, was 20 years old, a sophomore at John Carroll University, and for all we knew, doing very well. Dominique was a three-sport athlete in high school. He was attending John Carroll on academic scholarship and playing football, academically doing well, socially doing well. His mom and I had no concerns about him. He came home Thanksgiving weekend of 2007 and was just rambling about taking over the world. God worked for him. God wanted him to do all of these things. And at the time, his mom and I had divorced about a year prior, so he was coming home to his mom in Canton, Michigan, and I was working and living in Grand Rapids. And his mom called me and said, "Hey, you need to come home. Something is wrong." Our initial thought was that maybe he had gone off to school and experimented with drugs, and so we took him to a local hospital to be drug tested. And after a lengthy interview or exam, the doctors came out and told us there were no drugs or alcohol in his system, but that they were going to put him on a 72-hour psychiatric hold. The initial diagnosis was schizophrenia, and a few months later, they added the diagnosis of bipolar disorder. We learned very quickly how little we knew about mental illness, about his diagnosis in particular, what his treatment plan was going to be, what his life was going to look like going forward. And we really struggled for about two and a half years trying to understand continuity of care, the side effects of medication, how to keep him engaged in treatment, and so on. And so in 2009, after returning to school and coming back home, I got so concerned about his safety, frankly, that I left my corporate job and came home to be his full-time caregiver. And treatment appeared to be working. I took him to therapy 4 days a week. I made sure he ate well, took his medication, exercised, everything that the doctors told me to ask of him, I did. And, you know, we had our challenges some days, but for the most part, he did what he was asked.
Was he still in school? Did he have a normal routine at that time?
No. At that time, we had to pull him out of school. Dominique had two episodes between 2007 and 2009 when we had to pull him out of school. And so at that time, he was actually living with my mother. And at that time, my mother was 78, 79 years old, and a lot to ask for a grandmother to take on care for a grown man with serious mental illness, which she was very willing to do. But, you know, I told her he's my responsibility. And so, as I mentioned, in the late summer, early fall of 2009, I left my corporate job and moved back to Metro Detroit to be his full-time caregiver. And he was doing very well until really early 2010. I realized that he had stopped taking his medication, wasn't going to therapy as frequently. And one night, as a matter of fact, I was doing his laundry and I found a small bag of marijuana in his pants pocket. And I was very angry because I'm a very anti-drug person. And I knew, even then, in layman's terms, that adding marijuana and alcohol to a person who's living with schizophrenia and bipolar disorder, which are chemical imbalances in your brain, was not good. And so I took him to his next appointment with a psychiatrist, and I was surprised when I presented her with the information, because Dominique had told me, well, the marijuana helps make the voices go away. And I said, well, so did the prescription medication that you're on. But then he helped me understand two things. First of all, the doctor said, well, you're both right. The marijuana will help make the voices go away, but it'll be temporary. And she said, the voices will return in greater frequency and greater intensity. And there will come a time that the marijuana won't be strong enough, and he will graduate to stronger drugs, and you'll have a person living with co-occurring, you know, they'll have a substance use issue and a mental health issue. And so I was very alarmed by that. But Dominique also helped me understand the impact of stigma at that time. Dominique comes from a very loving family, and he was a very popular kid. He was a nice young man, well-liked. But when people found out about his mental illness, they pushed away. They, for lack of a better term, stigmatized him. His friends didn't want to hang out with him as much. He had friends and family who would say things to him like, don't let anybody tell you you're crazy. Don't take that medication. You don't know what's in it. You just need to focus harder. You need to pull yourself up by your bootstraps. And they did not understand, when you're dealing with schizophrenia, you're way past bootstraps. This is not a I can will myself to feel better situation. But the stigma was so strong that he said, well, Dad, I would rather people think I'm high than for them to know that I take medication for mental illness. And that was in late February, early March of 2010. I'll be honest, and I don't know that I handled this the best way, but I told him, I said, you can't bring drugs into my house. Because at the time I was dating and my current wife, and we were blending families. Part of when I left my job, I reached out to her and said, hey, you know, I know this isn't the way we planned it, but she was looking to build a better life for her two young children. I needed to spend time with Dominique. So we really abruptly decided to get an apartment together and, you know, commingle our families. And it wasn't just the children. Again, I just didn't care for drugs in the house. So Dominique chose to leave, and he went and stayed with an uncle who would allow him to do whatever he wanted to do. Unfortunately, Dominique's journey came to an end on June 27th of 2010, when we lost him to suicide. And as you can imagine, you know, losing a child is not a natural act. And frankly, I didn't handle the grief very well. I tried to, you know, us men are taught silence is strength. We're protectors and providers. I had three other children that were depending upon me. And so I tried to present as the father they knew. But I was masking, you know, my grief and my pain. I did see a therapist. I did join a grief support group for parents who lost children. And I was doing those things on the surface that you think you're supposed to do. But frankly, it was killing me inside. And, you know, I was suppressing the grief. And I stopped going to therapy because I literally just told my therapist one day, who was, I thought I'd been a client of his for years. And I just told him, I said, you can't fix me. I miss my son. And unless, you know, there's a way to bring my son back, you can't help me. So I stopped going to therapy and I tried to manage it on my own. But frankly, about 6 months after losing Dominique, I started experiencing suicidal thoughts of my own. And I just told God, I can't live with this pain. And if you can't help me end it, then I'll have to end it. And so I did. I went about the business of planning my suicide. And I planned on the year anniversary of Dominique's passing to go visit his gravesite and to not come home. Little did I know, my wife is amazing. Sonia always allowed me to visit Dominique's grave alone. There were times that I would take her when she needed to go, but it was very personal and private for me. And so the morning of June 27th of 2011, I had put some things away. And again, I planned to go there and not come home. But that morning, I noticed Sonya wasn't getting dressed for work. And I said, what's going on? She says, well, I'm going to spend today with you. And I told her, no, today's going to be a really bad day, and I just need to be left alone. And she defiantly said, and lovingly, I should say, said, I'm not asking you, I'm telling you. She said, I know what today is, and I'm not going to allow you to spend today alone. So she went to the cemetery with me, and we took our lawn chairs, and I took my Bible, and I prayed, and I cried, and I literally told God, look, I clearly won't do this while she's here, but I can always come back tomorrow. And it was then that God said, nope, got more for you to do. You take her hand, and you believe that I am God and God alone, and we will lead you through this. And so I'm so grateful that I didn't go through with that. I am grateful that he sent her to me. And as a result, Sonya never knew I was suicidal at the time. Matter of fact, she didn't find out until about 2 years after she happened to be sitting in a presentation that I was doing in Kalamazoo. And it was the first time that I publicly disclosed it. But she had no idea what my plan was that day. But she did know that I was struggling. She knew I was struggling with the grief. And so Sonya Googles everything. And she happened to come across NAMI. And I remember her telling me one day, she said, maybe helping others will help you. And so I went to my first NAMI family-to-family support group meeting in 2011, and in 10, 15 minutes, I fell in love with the organization. I said, these are people who know what I've been through. They understand. They didn't stigmatize me for having lost a child to suicide, because even in the support group that I attended for parents who lost children, it's one thing when you lost a child in a car accident or to a long-term illness or sudden illness. But when you say you lost a child to suicide, people look at you a little different. And it's almost like they think it's going to rub off. But I didn't feel that at NAMI. At NAMI, it was family. So I joined NAMI as a volunteer. It was maybe 6 months later that I was invited to join the board of directors as a volunteer. I did that for about 3 years. I served as the NAMI Walks chair, our fundraising walk event, for a couple of years, and I served as the vice president. And in early 2014, the board decided that we needed a change in leadership at the executive director position. And so, frankly, at the time, NAMI Michigan wasn't in good financial shape, and I didn't think that we could do a good job of finding a new executive director we could barely pay. So I volunteered to do it on an interim basis until we got the finances straightened out, and lo and behold, 10 years later, I'm still here.
Oh my gosh.
So, but I love the organization. I can't imagine doing anything else. I really can't. And so for as long as they will have me and as long as my health allows, I plan to be a part of NAMI. A part of the journey also has been, shortly after losing Dominique, we established the Dominique Fisher Memorial Foundation because we wanted to establish a scholarship at his alma mater, Detroit Catholic Central High School. Catholic Central was a great experience for him, not just academically, but socially. And Sonya and I thought that was a good way to establish something that would allow his legacy to live on. And so we've done that for the last 14 years. But what's really happened is we've learned the impact of stigma again, and it just kept coming up over the years. I worked with so many young people, and really people of all ages. So in 2021, we trademarked the Everybody versus Stigma brand. And the Everybody versus Stigma brand is the evolution of the Dominique Fisher Memorial Foundation, because it allows us to connect with people. It is a catchphrase that it's really surprised us how much it resonates with people across the country and across the world. And so we established the Everybody versus Stigma brand, but for us, it's much more than a brand. It's a movement. And wherever we are, wherever we travel, I get stopped in restaurants and hotels and airports and, hey, what's stigma? What's that all about? And it's a conversation starter. One of the ways we can help people who need behavioral health care treatment and encourage them is to normalize the conversation. It's to destigmatize behavioral health care, behavioral health diagnosis, not just mental illness, substance use disorder, people who identify with suicidal ideology, even people who are impacted or diagnosed with autism spectrum disorders or even intellectual developmental disabilities, because all of those have a mental health component to them. And so we wanted to be very inclusive. And so we established the brand. It's doing very well. And it allows us to grow Dominique's legacy.
Oh, thank you so much for sharing. Is there anything else you want to add, or you feel this has brought us full circle this morning?
You know, I think this has brought us full circle with our journey. But what I would add for your listeners is to remember, I know it sounds a little cliche because we hear it so much, but if you're faced with a behavioral health care challenge, you truly are not alone. There are millions and millions of us out here who support you. And I would encourage anyone who's challenged, contact your local NAMI. NAMI is an incredible resource, provides incredible resources at absolutely no cost to participants.
Thank you, Kevin. And I want to end by saying, may you continue to be blessed with good health so that you can continue this journey of yours advocating and educating and helping others.
Thank you.